Welcome back to this episode of All Damn Night. I'm your host, Brandon Richardson, with my co-host,
Sean Demers.
Sean, good to have you back.
Oh, yeah.
Always good to be here. This is a unique podcast. We are a music history podcast, but we just kind of hang out and talk about music history like we're hanging out with our friends.
All right.
That's kind of what we're doing. So we're not uniquely qualified to talk about this stuff, but fuck it, we do it anyways.
Well, it's fun, yeah.
And at the same time,
we're getting there. We're pretty close to becoming qualified.
I think, you know what? Yeah. I think we're going to take that line out. We are extremely unique and qualified, because where's your music history podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, thank you.
It's about time.
What we do is cover kind of esoteric stories about music history and hang out, have a good time, and hope you enjoy coming along with us on the ride. So Sean has dug a story up about... Well, he hasn't really told me about it.
I haven't told you yet. I will give you a hint, though. It was somebody special's birthday on January 9th of this year. Don't give it away if you know. But
could be several people.
Could be very many people, actually. Somebody at home is saying, oh, that's me.
I know.
But it's not you. Fuck you.
Yes. I second what Sean says. Fuck you.
So, you want to just get right into it?
Yeah, jump into it. Let's do this.
Damn night. So we're going to begin today in South America. Specifically Brazil.
Oh, I know exactly who this is. No, I'm
of
kidding.
Course.
Go ahead.
Take a guess.
You know, I've been watching way too much Hunting Hitler to be guessing random people in South America, so any of my guesses are just going to be
it
Nazis.
It is not him or her.
Yes, okay.
I promise you
then.
That. So we're talking about early 20th century on a warship in roughly 1910.
Oh, wow. Okay.
First of all, tensions are going to be high in Brazil at this time. Being the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery in 1888.
They also got the most slaves out of any country, like, by an incredible margin.
Is that right?
An incredible margin. They had 300, something, it's something like, we got 300,000 out of 300 million, and the rest went to South America, mostly Brazil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
They all basically came through one or two ports as well. Is that correct?
That's the highly overlooked aspect of slavery is that vast majority of them went to South America.
Huh.
And that's a real short.
I wish I had a star with a rainbow to shoot across the sky. Anyways, so there were still many opposed to the abolition, responding with a very successful coup d'etat in 1889.
I think it's pronounced coup d'etat.
I believe you might be correct, but I italicized it, so I just pronounce it French.
I see.
Because I think that's what that means, right? No, that Italian means italicized, right?
Yeah, I mean, just...
Okay.
I have no idea about the etymology of italicized.
So anyways, that was in 1889, and since then, Brazil was politically and economically unstable, to say the least.
Right.
Resulting revolts and rebellions plagued the turn of the century. And it wasn't until the global demand for coffee and rubber began to put Brazil on the map.
And this is what time? 1910?
1910.
Okay.
You know, roughly.
Yeah, so let's say early 20th century.
You know what? Let's say 1910 November, specifically.
Okay. Interesting you picked that
one. New leadership and politicians recognized the supply and demand aspect of the new capitalist society that they were beginning to develop. And on the flip side of the coin, though, the rising power had to start protecting its resources and borders. I don't know if you know anything about Brazil in 1900, but they're...
Well, we don't have enough space on the recording disc for that.
But their military might was not quite... as vast and strong as it could have been.
I wouldn't imagine so, no. I'm picturing more like six dudes with muskets and like somebody in a boat of some kind.
Okay.
Not a big
boat.
A boat.
Just
not a
normal
small boat. But a boat.
It's got an engine on it. Or a
motor. Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Oh, well,
no.
It does.
Okay.
So anyways, so the first item on the agenda of great importance would be to upgrade and modernize the Brazilian Navy.
Gotta get the boats in order.
Which at the time was rather archaic. And guess what they did?
telling you, two, rather archaic two, in 1910 two, means no motor. They had like the castaway set up. They had like a bunch of bamboo lashed together. And then like a sail. Tarps
with coca leaves.
They would get like 400 yards and they'd come back.
So how would you imagine the Brazilians would upgrade their navy?
Some badass pinstripes, maybe a little trolling motor, maybe a little live lift to put their bass in, hell yeah.
Yeah. Well, pretty darn close.
A Yeti cooler.
They bought two ships. Two.
Wow.
Two ships.
Two ships. What are they
named? They were not normal ships, though.
Well, no,
to give them credit, they were actually English. To give them credit, they bought two battleships of the dreadnought variety.
Oh, okay.
And according to Wikipedia, a dreadnought's design had two revolutionary features: an all big gun arrangement,
right,
or armament scheme, and with more heavy caliber guns than previous ships ever, and one of the first steam turbine.
The British Navy at the turn of the century was the powerhouse of the world. Like that was the reason that such a small country could like have that much, build that much of an empire.
They almost took over the whole world at one point.
It's why America is such the superpower today. It's our navy is insane beyond anybody else's. But yeah, the dreadnought was like badass turn of the century, pre-World War I.
We're talking about like the latest and greatest
machine. So they seriously upgraded.
Yeah, with two ships, mind you. And keep that in mind. So these ships were not even a decade old and had been proven tough and relentless by the British Royal Navy for a few years prior. All right, so now we get into the nitty-gritty. In the Brazilian Navy, social classes were still clearly drawn out, though.
Yeah.
Elite, quote-unquote, white officers ruled over Afro-Brazilian and Central American seamen, who were essentially slaves, even still today, in 1910.
Yeah.
It was really unfortunate. And they were actually treated as such by the higher-ranking individuals. Corporal punishment? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, corporal punishment? Yeah. The physical, actually, lashing and torture by today's standards?
It's funny you say that. Corporal punishment was still being used on these new vessels, even after most of the rest of the world had done away with such brutal tactics.
Right. So glad we gave them the Olympics.
Right. Even for the smallest of crimes, or even just a mistake or slip-up, a sailor could find himself being literally strapped to the bow guns and whipped. Literally, they were getting lashes. It was madness.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, like, social class had a lot to do with that. And then you got to think about, like, they didn't have a whole lot of antibiotics or anything, so...
Or education.
Well, no, but no, like those lashes on your back.
They could kill you.
Yeah, they could kill you. It could be a really severe, severe punishment. What a shitty place to be.
It really was. Yeah. And if you can put that into perspective, there might even be something worse than that. It's getting the same punishment for small and large crimes alike.
Wow.
So, no matter what they did, 100 lashes.
Kill somebody or steal a cup.
Yep, might as well be killing a bunch of people, you know?
Might as well kill you and then just take the cup.
And then just take the cup and not get 200 lashes.
It's a one deal. A guy only gets one punishment.
So,
you got a plan.
The leadership in this case was way out of line and even acting criminally themselves with this behavior. As you can imagine, this didn't sit well with the crew, who greatly outnumbered and overpowered the officers. So it was just a matter of time until the sailors did something about it.
Mutiny.
The result of the brutal treatment came the Revolt of the Lash in November 1910.
How are we having something called the Revolt of the Lash in the 20th century?
You know, it's insane.
That's my question.
It really is. This was a mutiny that happened in the capital of Rio de Janeiro in November 1910. The sailors took over both of the new dreadnought battleships.
Whoa.
Yep. A cruiser and an older warship that was soon to be retired anyway, so really it was just because they could.
It was probably like a kayak.
Yeah.
It's
probably just a fishing boat. Somebody fell overboard and they threw him a dinghy or something.
That hang out at the San Francisco Giants games waiting for balls to go over the wall.
They do that in Boston, too.
It's like, I got this. Like, I'm taking care of it.
Oh, man. A funny story about that. Taco Bell offered, what was it, to buy everyone in America a taco if they hit a home run in a big circle that they floated out in the river. And then somebody did it like twice in a row or something. So they just lost. They almost went bankrupt giving everybody in America
Poor Taco Bell. Poor Taco Bell.
So, anyways, here we go. This is the funny part. Collectively, the mutineers had more firepower in their four ships than the entirety of the rest of the Brazilian Navy. Four ships. And two of them were little rowboats.
I mean, like, those were the best four ships in the Brazilian Navy, two of which were rowboats.
And the other two were brand new English ships that they had just purchased for a ridiculous sum of money.
I'm telling you, like, the other stuff was just dudes in an inner tube with, like, a knife and a telescope.
Really was.
Swimming at you aggressively.
My thought is somebody fell overboard, so they lowered the lifeboat and then called that a captured ship.
We just keep expanding our navy. With every tragedy, we only get stronger.
Sounds like America. With every tragedy, we get stronger and more united. I wish it was the other way around.
They're doing their best, but they're no America. So we have way bigger tragedies, and we get way stronger, my friend.
We will brag. We will. Put your tragedies, blow them out of the water.
Keep the Olympics. We don't care.
Keep it right. So this whole rebellion was led by one man. And forgive me, I'm pronouncing
Royce
this.
Royce Gracie.
It's Joa Candido Felisberto. And I don't know who Royce Gracie is, should I?
Oh, you don't know who there is. The Gracie family is like the most famous Brazilian family probably going right now because they invented, they didn't invent, but they popularized Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they're kind of, they are kind of the originators of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And
what's the difference between Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and normal Jiu-Jitsu?
The guy that was there, he had somehow come to work as an immigrant in Brazil. He was from Japan.
He was probably a slave.
No. He was some kind of, I think he was a skilled worker of some kind, but he knew jiu-jitsu or was one of the originators of jiu-jitsu. It was pretty well known, though, because he worked with, like, Teddy Roosevelt and some other people.
Oh, wow.
But he ended up teaching great-great-great-grandfather, not three greats, maybe one great to the Gracie clan, and all their names apparently in Portuguese, if it's an R, you have to say it with an H.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it looks like Royce and Rorian and I'm blanking on the other ones now, but it's Royce and Rorian. Okay. Yeah, so
all right.
Future reference.
There we go.
There, if you're ever in Brazil for some god awful reason.
Noted. Well, I might go take over a battleship. It seems fairly easy.
I think you could get at least half of the Navy. Yeah.
So, anyways, it was all led by the one man, Felisberto. The sailors demanded one thing. Get ready for this. For the end...
what do you call them? Pina coladas?
Pretty damn close.
Oh, rum coladas.
The only thing they wanted was to stop the punishment.
Hey, guys, we have one crucial demand. We will give this back to you if you just don't punish us.
We tried asking nicely, guys.
Please. We won't kill you if you don't beat us.
Right. It was ridiculous. They were so mad about it, they mutinied the entire Navy.
Deal.
It is a very fair deal.
Their requests are reasonable.
And it was a great success. And not only that, every single person involved was granted amnesty.
See, there you go.
There you go.
Maybe Walmart workers should start with that.
Instead of saying, we want $15 an hour.
Stop beating us.
Yes.
We'll work from there. Yeah. We can work for these fine people.
20-minute breaks, twice a day, maybe.
That's called a starting point. Then you make deals
and,
from there.
Yeah, and then maybe mutiny again if you have to.
If you have
you
to.
You can't do it all at once.
It's just, it's a process.
So, grace and civility ruled the day when the mutineers decided not to slump to the level of their nasty officers, literally being the better men.
Ooh, but when you don't slump to the level of people in history,
it usually doesn't work out well. So, unfortunately, a completely unrelated rebellion took place just 3 weeks later and landed almost all of the mutineers in the breaks.
Like, how many rebellions do you even have time? How do you have time to plan another rebellion in 3 weeks?
Yeah,
that's an ad hoc rebellion.
They tried for too much. You're right.
That's,
they're just.
That's.
They
like,
should have listened to Phyllis Berto. All we need right now is just to stop the beating.
It's like when the NFL advocates like more games in their season. It's like, no, you need plenty of time off in between rebellions to recover
or
and plan
over books.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. There's only a certain number of seats.
I think people have two or three rebellions a year.
Yeah.
Tops.
Okay.
And a good rebellion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously one was a success, but the other one was poorly timed.
Yeah. Okay.
Someone lost their temper. But this is the way of the world. Give and take. So keep that sentiment in mind as we continue on with our story.
Okay.
Let's jump back to the beginning of all this. In the mainland, in the heart of the Amazon rainforest, we pick up our story once again with the life and times of a young squirrel.
A young squirrel?
Squirrel.
Okay.
We shall call him, how about Joe?
Okay, Joe the squirrel.
Joe the squirrel.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter.
Pitch meeting for a cartoon?
Our new little furry friend's life was not easy either. Every day was a constant struggle for survival.
Was he in the Brazilian Navy?
He was Brazilian. So
well,
I think that makes him
Brazil nuts
qualified. I believe if you tune in for just a few more seconds, we'll find out exactly what he was eating. Although there was plenty of food for the little critter to eat, he himself was also plentiful food for the bigger, more vicious creatures. The chance of survival and maturity were not all that great, which makes the end result of our story all that more amazing. So, being born into this crazy world in South America, our squirrel friend was surrounded by super powerful vibes of civil and political unrest. There were booming economies of war.
I wonder how he chose what political ideology to follow.
I think he was just trying to make a living, scratch out a living
from
the jungle.
And I mean, you can't just put your head in the ground.
You really can't. He's up in the trees. He's
squirrel
hearing
or no
and
squirrel.
Seeing everything that's going on.
Do you
want to
be part of the problem or part of the solution? Joe?
So Joe, or Eric. We could call him Eric if you want.
We didn't make up our mind because it's going to be hard to get his paperwork filled out.
How about we call him Jeff?
Are we gonna pick
Jeff Beck? Does it maybe? I don't know.
Jeff Beck the squirrel?
Let's call him Jeff Beck the squirrel.
Okay.
Alright. So there were booming economies of war, yet starving slaves still occupying the undoubtedly beautiful landscape. From electrical signal to spark of an idea, and all the way up from birth to death, our squirrel was subconsciously influenced its entire existence by what was going on around him in the world.
Okay. Pretty intuitive squirrel.
Well, he didn't realize it, but still. It is more than fitting that one day the little bushy tail came across a bounty full of ripe seed pods under a beautiful, mature mahogany tree. He takes them back to his little nest home and begins to feast, dropping a seed there, dropping a seed here.
Yeah, be careful, squirrel.
Right. And he's sloppy. But it only took one. So randomly perfect in every way. Dropped so expertly by the squirrel on a sunny, damp, and fertile tract. This would be forever the birthplace of the Brazilian mahogany tree that forever changed the world of rock and roll music.
Really?
For sure.
Okay. All right.
Just like the squirrel and the sailors in the Brazilian Navy, Every day was a fight for their lives. They struggled constantly for sunlight and protection from the elements. Terrible vibes from the world around them tried to bring them to their knees in agony. But also the new world vibes of love, peace, and harmony seemed to overpower the previously mentioned.
Ooh.
This tree had begun to become something much more than just a plant. With roots seated deeply into the lush and vibrant earth, the tree took on the characteristics of the times and of the land, giving it almost mystical powers. Spooky.
So feeding the acid, or what's going on with this tree?
Well, I mean, in the rainforest.
Ayahuasca?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. So every year, growing stronger and more dense, becoming mature and significantly unique, this special life form stood out from all the rest, and eventually caught the eye of an American manufacturer by the name of Gibson in roughly 1950.
I'll be damned.
Yeah. So, the order had been placed. Local farmers cleaved the tree clean from the forest.
Come here, tree!
Cleave it, quick, leaving a gaping hole in the canopy where the limbs once stretched out. Sunlight poured in as the tree fell with a mighty crash. New seed pods spread out on the very spot where the mighty mahogany once stood. Circle of life type shit. Again, the give and take.
Yeah, dude, and who gives a shit about a rainforest when we gotta make rock and roll?
Right.
Right?
You would do very well
if you don't
in
agree
1950s
with that sentiment,
America.
Then I think this is the wrong podcast for you.
Yeah, it may be.
Wow.
But now is your defining moment. You get to decide whether to stay with us or
and
go your
I
own way.
I encourage you to stay with us because we're truly not anti. We're not pro destruction of the rainforest. It's a joke.
Although guitars are awesome, and if I did have to choose,
guitars.
It would be very difficult.
Okay, yeah, it'd be difficult.
Oxygen or guitars. I guess I can take a guitar to Mars.
Yeah, but do you need some smart-ass squirrel sitting up there hoarding his nuts away? Some fucking jaguar out there tripping balls on ayahuasca all day. Snakes trying to kill you everywhere.
Everything.
A bunch of beetles that just want to carry your babies away.
Yep.
Do you need that shit, or do you
In this case in particular, yes, you do. Because the tree would never have grown if the seed...
But we got the tree.
We did get it.
So, fuck the squirrel.
Fuck the squirrel now.
Fuck you, Jeff Beck, the
we
squirrel.
We don't care about Jeff Beck, the squirrel.
We need actual Jeff Beck.
Yeah. Well...
Who's named after the squirrel, I would presume.
Yes. Surprisingly, yes. The Brazilian great squirrel.
The things you
The
learn.
Creator of mahogany trees. Yes, Jeff Beck the
so
squirrel.
So Gibson's down there chopping down trees.
Yep, yep. So the,
cutting
well,
holes in the ozone.
Yes. The world had no idea the importance of this tree at the time, but they would soon find out. And it certainly wasn't important in the traditional sense, like giving shelter or creating oxygen.
I wonder if he was walking around like, hey guys... This is the most important tree of all time.
Is it?
He hasn't built anything with it yet.
You're full of shit.
He's like, what are you... It's a tree. No, it's the most important tree of all time. It's going to revolutionize American music.
It's like, would you shut up, Jeff Beck?
Still looks like a tree.
Yeah. Jeff Beck over here is always talking about this tree. We make him eat his nuts by himself now.
Jeff Beck and his nuts, man.
He is nuts. So after some refining at the factory in a short burst of hellfire in the kiln, the spirit of our magnificent tree would only lie dormant for one last short stretch, lying in wait for the masterful selection of an unknown godlike Luther. The heart and soul of the great mahogany was contained within perhaps only one block of stock. Once chosen, this breathing entity began its second existence. Already matured and distinct with dense personality, tone, and life, this heart was crafted into something revolutionary yet again. Another coup had begun. The revolt against normality, physical proof
Fuck
that
you,
higher
normality.
Power exists in guitar form, an almost perfect specimen, which we will get into shortly.
You'd be a good narrator for that show, How It's Made, where they just talk about how, like, garden hoses or frozen pizzas.
I love that. I've often talked about wanting to work at Home Depot. And
yeah, give them a call.
I should. I'm not Canadian, though. Well, actually, half Canadian.
Oh, well, there you go.
I think that's all you do. I think so. Just, I'm qualified to work at How It's Made, just like anybody from Brazil can be a sailor.
You could run the Brazilian Navy with your qualifications right now.
Yes. So, the mythical, magical, mysterious, a lot of M's, 1959 Gibson Les Paul Standard was born.
A classic.
The bar of all bars. Yeah. The guitar to own if you want to buy a guitar.
I think it'd be hard to argue that.
It would be very
You could start a lot of angry people upon a discussion board, but I think it'd be hard to make a... To tell you you're wrong.
I mean, they're not here, so...
They're not here. Fuck them.
Quickly scooped up by an amazing young guitarist named Joe Walsh of the Yardbirds, and later the Eagles. A guitar got its first home, but this guitar was not for Joe. And somehow he knew this from the beginning. The guitar never got a rest, though, and it was used constantly and modified heavily. One might say it was being warmed up for its rightful owner, a true sword-in-the-stone-like scenario. Later, a masterful tech and luthier shaved down the neck to a 60s-thin profile.
Real quick, just for people that don't know, a luthier is...
Maker of strings instruments.
Right, right. I knew that, just to clarify. Well, sure. I knew that.
No, you didn't.
But people...
I can see the bewilderment
there,
on your face.
People that are listening...
You thought it was like a race car driver.
Look, there's two things I know, Sean. Brazilian slavery and luthiers.
Okay.
That's it.
If you said that very confidently.
I don't know much, but I know those two things.
So anyways... The work was done so precisely that, and I quote Joe, you could stick a pocket knife in the back of this neck and hit the truss rod. No, that's Jeff.
Oh, the guy that plays with the Eagles. Yeah. Okay.
So not only did this show the supreme quality of the workmanship and the instrument itself, it showed how strong the guitar would be, and it would most definitely need to be.
Right.
In the early days of the Yardbirds, Eric Clapton began to seek other work. He just wasn't happy.
He's never fucking happy. Oh my God. And don't get me wrong. I love Joe Walsh and I love Eric Clapton.
Yep.
Well, my take isn't related at all. I just love Joe Walsh. He's just a fucking cool guy. Who's awesome, fun to hang around. Eric Clapton is awesome, but he's never fucking happy.
Even when he's riding with B.B. King.
He's always just kind of, I could be doing something else. I'm super talented.
You know what it is? He could be doing coke.
Yeah, or heroin or whatever else he was. Yeah, that's true. And don't get me wrong, I like Eric Clapton. I'm just saying.
I like coke.
Thank you. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Wondering where this podcast is.
Upon leaving the band, Eric, there needed to be a replacement. But who? Who would the Yardbirds choose? Well, there was this little weird kid always hanging around the studio and even filling in at times for absent members. Guess they should give him a try, right? Huh?
I don't know, he's kind of weird, kind of little.
Right. He kind of young, but who was he? Just someone named Jimmy Page.
Yeah, I don't like the sweater vest. He's a little skippily for me.
They didn't get into all the weird dresses.
Is this that nerd that was on the BBC playing the banjo a couple years ago?
It was, actually.
Yeah, I don't know, guys. We're a blues band. We're trying to be cool, you know?
So anyways... In my opinion, he may be the best guitarist of all time.
I know, one of those things.
It's tough to.
Another thing that would just light up a discussion board.
It really would.
I prefer to look at it in terms of like my top fives, because that's always evolving. But yeah, he's in the top five. I think almost anyone. I think it depends on your style, but like, yeah, anyone, any mainstream guitarist, anyone that's listened to rock and roll in the last 50 years would probably have Jimmy Page in their top five. Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of kids and millennials that are saying, oh, well, this guy's better. I'm like, well,
maybe technically.
He learned everything he knew from Jimmy, and Jimmy learned everything he knew from Joe Walsh.
Fair enough. So, I mean, like, I think that you're really giving discussion board people to a lot to talk about. I don't know that he learned everything he knows from Joe Walsh. I think
you'd be surprised.
But like, he was already a trained musician on the BBC like 15 years.
He was very good
at
his craft. Joe Walsh honed.
What, we have a story behind this?
We do, but that's a story for another time.
Okay.
So I could go on for days and days about Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin and the heavy metal dynasty they created.
And we will.
We will. But this is just a very specific episode about a guitar.
Okay.
So Jimmy joined the band, the Yardbirds, but was always, even from the start, envious of Walsh's Les Paul. The aforementioned 1959 standard. Years would go by. Bands had been formed and dissolved. Led Zeppelin was just starting to come up, and timing was perfect. Walsh got on a plane and flew out to Jimmy, charging him only the travel expenses. Joe bestowed the Les Paul upon Jimmy. He said, and I quote, "The kid needed a real Les Paul, and Jimmy's Telecaster had seen better days."
That was going to be my question. He was playing a Tele before
his
this,
whole
right?
life.
Yeah.
And the guy known to play a Les Paul. If you say Les Paul, the first
Pretty
guy
much,
you say
man.
Is
it would
Jimmy
be,
Page.
It would be Jimmy Page and then Slash, but it would be Jimmy Page first because...
Yeah, isn't that weird? Eggs. And he played his Tele until it was literally falling apart.
And did he, and not that this has anything to do with the episode, but do you know if he recorded any stuff with Zeppelin on that Tele, or is everything...
Very little.
Very little, okay. So some of it was, that's what I've
Up
heard.
Up until Led Zeppelin, he was playing the Telecaster.
All Tele though, yeah, okay.
And then at this time,
so
Joe
perfect.
Walsh was like, you know what? I don't even like this guitar. It's not for me.
Yeah.
I love that it's a 1959.
Right.
I could sell it for $1 million.
It's not an easy guitar to play.
Quite the contrary.
Yeah.
Quite the contrary. Yeah. It is actually very easy. And we will get into that
I don't
right
think,
here.
Well, it depends on what your style is. It depends on what your
style
is.
Yes.
Because I could see it not being... Because Joe's a Strat player, right? So, like, if you're a Strat guy, it's probably not your cup of tea. You're probably a Strat guy because you're a Strat guy.
Right.
But, like, I
Strats are very easy to play.
You can dig a lot out of them. Yeah. I think, like, the Les Paul presents, like, way more sustain. Obviously, it's got that crazy sustain.
I play a Les Paul.
Yes, you do.
And I won't pick up any other guitar. I have a Strat. It's covered in dust.
There you go.
It's just one of those things, though. I can get what I want from a Les Paul that I can't do. It's work for me on a Stratocaster. You just can't get that sweet honey butter, man.
Yeah,
just
Jimmy went to it for a reason, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So, from an article from an Iconic Axes website, Iconic Axes.
Website,
Jimmy instantly grew attached to his new guitar. And I quote Jimmy, "As soon as I played the Les Paul, I fell in love. Not that the Tele isn't user-friendly, but the Les Paul was gorgeous and easy to play.
Yeah.
It just seemed like a good touring guitar. It was certainly a contrast from the Telecaster I had been using. It's more of a fight with the Tele, but there are rewards. The Gibson's got all that very stereotyped sound, maybe. I don't know. But it's got a really beautiful sustain. I do like sustain. It relates to bowed instruments." Sustain speaks for itself. That's the whole thing. And it's the whole, or that, everyone's been experimenting in. Once it becomes electric, if you think about it, it was mainly sustain.
Can you,
Jimmy Page.
Okay, and this is something, I'm going to preface this by saying this is something that I do know.
Okay.
But Sean's technical music knowledge is better than mine, so you'd be better suited to explain this to the layman. But can you explain what sustain is and then why the Les Paul has such good sustain?
I will explain why first.
Absolutely.
Les Paul,
any order that you choose.
So this mahogany tree that we were talking about grew to maturity in perfect conditions and became so dense.
Super dense.
And heavy. And that's where sustain comes from. If you take a block of steel and hit it with a hammer, it'll ping.
Right.
And go on and on and on and on. But if you do that with a piece of wood, it's just a thud.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So the more denser the material, the more sustain it's going to have. What is sustain is a totally different world altogether.
But just it means like that note.
So
hanging.
You can hold a note with proper intonation or feel.
Yes.
And have it go on and on and on and on and on.
Right. And the Les Paul is just known for that.
It really is. Mine is, what, 8 pounds. Slash plays like a 10-pound guitar.
How heavy is this one we're talking about
here? This one we're talking about here originally was maybe 12.
Gosh.
And then it was heavily, heavily modified, which we'll get into shortly, by while still in Walsh's hands.
Okay.
So like, or I mentioned earlier, he brought the whole neck down. So it was built in late 1950s.
Yes.
The neck profile was almost double at that
meaning
point.
A much wider neck?
Much wider, much thicker. Yeah. So what his tech did was sand it and shave it down to almost half. So okay. Where the internals, the metal truss rod was almost showing. Like if you wanted to, you could poke it. You could hit the
right.
Break through the wood. It was so thin at that point. And it was asymmetrical, which is cool as well. The 1959s were symmetrical, like a half of a circle. And then he shaved it down to a 60s thin profile, if not even further than that, which is almost like an airplane wing shape.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah,
it's not like a circle. It's got like a curve and then another curve
as well. Yeah.
Which is cool. And
and we'll post some pictures with the episode so you get what we're talking about.
Anyways, we were talking about sustain after Jimmy Page. And Page used that 1959 Les Paul standard number one on almost every album and show for Led Zeppelin to date after that. He never put it down. You might be thinking, though, why do you call it number one? Well, let me explain.
Well, why do you call it number one?
It's funny you should ask. There are actually two, or technically three, but really the main contenders are Les Paul number one and Jimmy Page Les Paul number two.
Okay.
Two or three nearly identical 1959 Les Paul standards in Jimmy Page's rig.
So this is current day or in the 70s?
From the time that he got Joe Walsh's Les Paul
until
he said, I need another one. Because you can't... We'll get into it in a different episode because we're not going to talk about number two really. But it was always in alternate tunings, mainly.
That was going to be my other question. Gap. He works a lot in alternate tunings. Would he use another guitar for that?
So number one was always in standard.
Standard, okay.
And number two was always in dadgad.
Okay, now this is going to be a little nerd talk that we're just not going to have time to explain. But if you are a guitar dude, does he have any of this stuff? Like, so he's got the open tuning or standard or the dadgad going on the number two.
Yeah.
Does he play? Like, do they play half step down or like that, or is it just standard straight
up?
It
really depends. That would be up to Robert Plant.
Plant, okay.
Yeah. But Jimmy Page would play standard E.
Okay.
The exact frequency, I couldn't tell you.
Nah, the rest of the stuff you can Wikipedia. I just wanted to make sure that we're feeding our guitar nerds, too.
So, again, this guitar was slightly modified by Page. He added a push-pull pots, which are the things that you turn on the guitar face or top cap. And what they did was put the pickups, the humbuckering pickups, out of phase. So instead of being all one direction of electrical signal flow, it would be like two magnets when you put them together on opposite poles.
Oh, whoa.
So they would be out of phase. And this was to replicate the early Fleetwood Mac style under the leadership of Peter Green.
Peter Green, yeah.
Amazing.
Great blues band.
Totally different band.
Totally different. Stevie Nicks.
We say Fleetwood Mac. Yeah, we say Fleetwood Mac, but it does not sound like Fleetwood
Mac. Yeah, when I talk about the Fleetwood Mac that I like, it is before Stevie Nicks.
A blues band.
Nah.
The goat. So, it's funny, the give and the take. After a hardware malfunction, the top pickup on Les Paul number one was replaced with a chrome T-top humbucker and remained that way for the remainder of Led Zeppelin. Again, the give and take. You broke the guitar, but got the quintessential Les Paul Led Zeppelin sound out of it.
So why does that give it... What is it about the humbucker that gives it that... Because we're talking like a really full, beefy tone, right? It's a double pickup.
Warm,
basically.
Yeah. Super warm. You can get insane, clean, high volume out of it that you can't get from a Strat or a Tele. You can get the distortion and the sustain, obviously. But they're as far as I'm concerned, they're two different instruments.
There's no other instrument that could have created Led Zeppelin.
There really is not. Yeah. Same thing with Rush. Gibson sound for AC/DC.
Yeah.
The reason Angus plays a SG is because they are much faster and easier to play.
Okay.
And he's essentially playing lead guitar while Jimmy Page is the front man, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jimmy Page has to play rhythm and lead.
And lead, yeah.
Yeah, at the same time. So he needs the bigger, more options.
Yeah, and, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So,
just things like that. Also, he changed the tuning machines to Grovers, which are just like those. Jimmy said, "The only thing I did was change the tuning machines to sealed Grovers," which was familiar.
We know, Jimmy.
we just talked about it from my Les Paul custom, which is funny because he had maybe a dozen Les Pauls at this point.
Yeah, that's going to be my question. Yeah. He's got to have a ton of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but just playing this one.
But as soon as he got the Les Paul, he never put it down.
Right.
And to this day, he still plays it. Well, actually, now he, even with the Black Crows and stuff like that, he plays number three.
Okay. Okay.
But Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So.
So he does he? It, but he hasn't retired number one.
No. Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. No. I don't think it ever will be.
Okay.
No,
there's cool, no such man. Thing. That's awesome.
Jimmy Page is begging Robert Plant on a weekly basis to play Led Zeppelin songs live. Robert, that is all he cares
for. Robert.
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 Let's go back on a houseboat.
Robert.
Let's write Led Zeppelin 7.
Please do it, guys.
Yeah.
We'll get a Kickstarter together.
Definitely.
We couldn't afford it.
But you got to imagine how tough that is for Robert Plant, though. Being on tour while his son died and things like that.
Oh my gosh, that's just the whole... Yeah.
So he can't even think about Led Zeppelin.
It's a thing that, I didn't understand. It's not funny at all. I didn't understand that about Led Zeppelin. And then when you understand what Robert Plant's life has been like...
Yeah, and Robert Plant and John Bonham were, besties.
Best friends, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hard road he's had to hoe, that's
so
for sure.
So, my guitar guy at a store here in Austin told me the story one time when Robert Plant was living here, or still is. He was hanging outside the guitar store at 7:30 a.m. And this guy, and my guitar guy walks up and says, going to work when they first open.
Right.
Says, man, we'll be open in about 30 minutes. He walks in, unlocks and locks the door again. And there's just this hobo sitting on the side outside
Stay
the door.
Stay out there, hobo.
Stay out there in the cold, you fucker. He's spitting and throwing water.
What have you ever done for anyone?
Yeah. So then his boss shows up and thinks nothing of it. And it's who's this guy sitting on the step? And then this kid shows up and goes, that's fucking Robert Plant. He waited. Robert Plant waited outside the guitar shop so humbly for someone to...
What's he going to do? Right? What are his options?
He could say, do you know who the fuck I am?
You can't do that.
He could do
you
that.
You can't,
he
though.
He could do that,
You can't
though.
Ever do that. Because no, then it's could. Game over. Because then you lose... all the clout you had. You shouldn't, the whole point of being who you are is you shouldn't have to say it.
Right.
So if he has to say it, you get what I'm saying.
Yes. It's
I'm not
funny.
Here to defend myself.
And this huge rock star dated, a bar owner here for
I heard that. I don't know anything about that, but yeah, I've heard that.
It's another episode for another time. But yeah, he waited outside of
We're going to make a 45-minute episode out of Robert Plant's bartender girlfriend. Are you going to find her and interview her?
We could. It's the Broken Spoke here in Austin, Texas.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. So, anyways... over the years, there had been many accusations and theories revolving around the guitar's actual production year, because when Walsh modified it, they refinished it and shaved off the serial number. But I am here to tell you that it is, in fact, a 1959 Les Paul.
Oh, so I see. So they're saying, oh, it's a...
There would be no reason why Jimmy Page when would have first... three of them if they were not, in fact, all identical.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And when was the... when was the first year that they started making the Les Pauls? Early 50s?
Ooh, you're going to upset the guitar nerds when I can't tell you. It was...
To be fair, you're going to upset guitar nerds no matter what you do.
The very, very first solid body electric guitar was the Les Paul.
Let's say in the 50s.
Way before Stratocaster.
But way before 59, they would have been... It could have been a 55, 57, whatever.
We'll leave it in the notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so... to this day, number one continues to be Jimmy Page's go-to in the studio and live.
Wow.
Once finally with the master, the mystical powers grew and the sound became stronger and stronger. From a majestic tree in Brazil to the summed up sound of a whole rock and roll generation. We give you happy birthday, Jimmy Page.
Happy birthday, Jimmy!
The Les Paul number one.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in this episode of All Damn Night. Just astounded by the tale of Jimmy Page's guitar. That's a badass episode, man. I'm really glad we did that. That was cool.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, so thanks for tuning in.
Stay tuned for the Jimmy Page episode.
We
got way carried away with little squirrels.
We have
and
a
things
big year coming up. Yeah, we've got a big episode in the works. Got a couple
got
cool
some
stories
new
coming
platform,
up for you.
Maybe a website. In the works. But
so things are starting to pick up here, and I want to thank you again for tuning in. I guess we hit 1,000 downloads. So that's a big
milestone.
Yeah, a couple while ago. Yeah. So. Doing great. I want to thanks so much. Wouldn't be able to do it without you. Check us out on social media at twitter.com/alldamnnight. We're on instagram.com/alldamnnightpodcast. If you have any show tips or suggestions, topic ideas, anything like that, hit us up at alldamnnightpodcast@gmail.com. And like Sean said, we'll have the website and bunch of other stuff rolling here shortly in the future.
Everything's going to still be free.
Yeah, it's all free. And we plan on keeping it that way. So thanks again, and we will talk to you next episode.